I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we welcome Donovan X. Ramsey to the show. Donovan is a journalist and author, and he's here today to discuss his debut book, When Crack Was King, A People's History of a Misunderstood Era. It's a poignant and thoroughly researched expose on the crack epidemic of the 1980s and 90s. It's told through stories of 4 affected individuals. I have to say, this book was one of my most anticipated books of the year. I read it and it lives up to my own personal hype. So there you go, folks. Donovan and I talked today about politics and media during the crack era, the way that Donovan crafted this book, and what he hopes to accomplish by sharing these stories. Remember, our book club selection for July is Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. I'll discuss the graphic novel with Joel Christian Gill on July 26th. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. And if you want more of The Stacks, you can join The Stacks Pack. It's just $5 a month. And if you join, you have access to our monthly virtual book club hangs, The Stacks Pack Discord, and The Stacks bonus episodes. You have the backlist ones and the ones that are coming out next. And this month, we're going to be discussing the HBO series Watchmen to go along with our book club episode on the book Watchmen. So yes, you're going to want to join The Stacks Pack to hear all of that juiciness too. Head to patreon.com/thestacks to join. Shout out to our newest members of the Stacks Pack, Kristen Hazel, Erica Simmons, and Kate Palmer. Thank you all so much, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Donovan X. Ramsey. All right, everybody, I am so excited. If you have been following me on Instagram, if you have been listening to this podcast, you have heard me talk about this book. It is one of my most anticipated books of the year. And guess what? It did not disappoint. Thank God. I am joined today by the author of When Crack Was King, A People's History of a Misunderstood Era, Donovan X. Ramsey. Welcome to the Stacks.
Hey, Tracy. Thank you for having me.
I'm just so excited to have you. I'm so grateful this book exists. So let me just start there. Thank you for doing this for us, for the culture, for the world.
Wow. No, thank you for saying that. I'm the thing, you know, I wrote the book that I set out to write. So it's like nice to see it exist in the world and, you know, people get to experience it.
Oh, I love that. Okay. In about 30 seconds or so, just tell people what the book's about.
Okay. So the book is, I call it, A People's History of the Crack Epidemic. It is both a chronicling of the rise and fall of crack, but also the lives of 4 people who were touched intimately by the epidemic. And it's a book that it took me about 5 years to write. I went out all over the country to the cities that were the hardest hit and interviewed hundreds of people. And I pulled together this story that really illustrates both the vulnerabilities that exist in our society that led to the crack epidemic, but also the ways that we survived it.
Where did you get the idea for the book?
So I got the idea for this book because I, you know, am really a child of the crack era. I was born in 1987. I grew up in the 90s and in a neighborhood that was hard hit by crack. And, you know, my like earliest memories, you know, are of the, you know, guys hanging out on the corners and my mom telling me to look away and to mind my business. My earliest memories are of, you know, my first bike being stolen by an addict. I like, you know, lost the air in my tire and I was too scared to go home and tell my mom. And this guy was like, hey, I can fix that for you. So, you know, I gave him my bike and stood there for hours and he never came back. So for me, you know, I grew up in that environment, but I was really sheltered from the environment by my mother, thank God. And that just left me with tons of questions about what exactly was happening and why it was happening to my community. And as I got older, there, you know, weren't any books. I was surprised that I actually tried to answer that question. So that's the book that I set out to write.
And then once you set out to write the book, how did you figure out how it would work formally? And for people who don't know, sort of, I should tell you how it's set up. Basically, Donovan is sort of writing four different stories of four different people who experienced the crack epidemic in different places in the country. And then also weaving in the history and sort of the politics of the time. The books are not the same, but what I kind of compare it to is The Warmth of Other Suns, where it's like you have these people who are journeying with us through this time period, but also Donovan is making sure that we have like the important information that maybe Kurt or Leni like wouldn't tell us. Like they're not going to be like, so this is what Nixon was up to. So it's sort of a combination of like this, it's definitely narrative nonfiction, but it's a combination of like personal stories and then also like the bigger picture. So how did you figure out that that's how you wanted to do it?
You know, you got it exactly right. I stole Isabel Wilkerson's flow exactly. That I read The Warmth of Other Suns and I thought, well, this is why you write a book. That this is why you take this form, something of this length, to give context to something that people think they understand. So, you know, I saw what she did with, you know, those three characters who kind of illustrated different perspectives. And I thought, well, how could I do this for a story as big as the crack epidemic? And I really tried not to. Like, you know, at one point I wanted to do the book entirely about Washington, D.C. as the nation's capital. But then I realized crack hit neighborhoods in different cities at different times. It declined at different times, that it was sort of expressed in different ways, right? So like on the West Coast in LA, you get Bloods and Crips and gang culture. And, you know, on the East Coast, you get like Jamaican posses and like Dominican dealers. And, you know, the story in DC is so political. So it seemed to me that, you know, in order to write something definitive, I had to kind of spread out and kind of make it kaleidoscopic, you know, was the goal.
Yeah. And then how did you source your people? You have, you know, a politician, you have people who were selling crack, people who were doing crack. Like, how did you decide, or I guess, what was the process to finding them? Or did you go in saying like, I want to find someone like this? Did you go in saying, I know I want Kurt Schmoke? Like, how did you figure out, and like, were there people that maybe you thought you were going to use, then you were like, oh, this doesn't work anymore, like this story is too repetitive to someone else's or something else like that?
You know, it was really, really hard, Tracy. It was so, like, the task was I needed to find people whose lives and experiences sort of demonstrated different perspectives of the crack epidemic.
Right.
So, you know, like, I knew that I needed to have a former addict. I knew that I needed to have a dealer. I really wanted to have an elected official to kind of like illustrate that like policy perspective. And I knew that I wanted to have someone who was related to an addict or a dealer, because that's the experience of so many Black Americans, is that you may have not been personally involved in the drug trade, but I think many of us love somebody or loved somebody that was involved. So that perspective needed to be there. And so it was, you know, that was the mandate. And I traveled mm-hmm. to the 10 hardest hit cities, and I just, you know, went into barbershops. I went into hair salons. I went into community centers, and I, you know, asked people questions and just talked about what I was doing. And there was this outpouring of stories and of experience. And I put out some open calls on Twitter and Instagram. And again, there was an outpouring. I realized that people were, that these stories were on the tip of their tongues, that they, you know, were seeing sort of the conversations come back up, but they didn't feel like they had a chance to have their say. So I ultimately settled on the four sort of characters that I have. Lenny Woodley, a former user out of South Central LA, Elgin Swift, whose father was an addict for many years out of New York, Kurt Schmoke, who's the former mayor of Baltimore, and Sean McRae, who was a dealer out of Newark, New Jersey. I settled on them because, one, they were willing to talk to me.
Right.
Two, they had stories that felt like they were representative of mm-hmm. the kind of folks that they were standing in for. And mm-hmm. they just, I mean, you know, when you read the book, you'll see, like, I just fell in love with them.
Yeah.
You know, that they just
so clear
felt like people that I knew. And, you know, they kind of just had that spark that we just vibe like that. So, right. you know, that's why they ended up right. in the book.
Okay. So let me ask you this then about the subjects that you ended up picking. I think, like, one of the things that's tricky about a book like this is that you end up, if you're talking to people who survive something like this, with sort of like a rosier outlook on the whole situation. Because if you were interviewing someone at the time, you know, like, maybe they die, maybe they end up in prison. But in this case, 40 years after the fact, like, we know from the beginning that they're at least in a place where they're comfortable, like, talking to you, and they have at least their life together to a point, or they survived this far. And I'm wondering, like, how that affected sort of your storytelling or your approach as an author trying to paint, like, a people's history, knowing that for so many people, it ended very, very badly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. You know, it was difficult. A difficult decision to make, to sort of make the book entirely about these four people who survived it. But, you know, ultimately, I decided that the history that exists, that was told by mainstream media, mm-hmm. already had so much death right. and devastation. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. my book, I wanted to not necessarily correct that, right? But to supplement it with these other stories of survival. And also knowing that for each of them, even within their lives and their stories, there are so many people who didn't survive.
Right.
So, you know, Sean McRae, for example, you know, was able to avoid, you know, any major jail time for the, you know, the fact that he was selling drugs for over a decade or so. But most of his friends got locked up. And a really right. good friend of his, you know, Mad Dog, was killed when he was a very young man. And, right. you know, Sean is still living with and dealing with the fallout of that, of the destruction of his community, the Hayes Homes projects. So, you know, even his story of survival gives you windows into the devastation.
Right. Okay. One more question about this, and then I have many others. But how, like, this is a pretty formal question, but how do you decide who gets to talk when? Like, how do you decide, okay, because, like, in the beginning of the book, we hear a lot from Lenny, and then we don't hear from her for a while. And I have my own assumptions about why that happens that way. But how are you as the author thinking about, like, okay, in the early 1980s, like, we really want to hear from Sean, and, like, Sean's sort of our narrator throughout the whole thing, and Elgin sort of, you know, comes up a little more later. And, like, what are the logistics of you figuring out who gets to say what when?
Yeah, it was a really hard book to write in terms of mostly around the structure, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, I had done tons of reporting before and tons of writing before. So that stuff came a little more easily to me. But putting together a book of this length, it's over 400 pages, and weaving together first just the rise and fall of crack, but then the lives of these four individuals in different cities who never meet was right. like a really big and, like, ambitious task. Ultimately, what I had to do was to lay out all of their stories just chronologically. mm-hmm. and to really figure out, knowing that the meta history had to be sort of the spine of the right. book, in that their stories should branch out from the meta history. So leading with whose story connected most at that time to what was happening in the larger story of crack. Yeah. And, you know, there are periods where, you know, because Elgin's the youngest, he doesn't appear for a while, that everybody else's life right. sort of are, or at least their story on that timeline begins, and his takes a little bit longer. And then Lenny, literally because, you know, because she was actively using every day for a long period, there are huge swaths of time that she just doesn't remember.
Right. And that's because, what I thought.
Yeah, you know, then also because so much of what she experienced was traumatizing and she was completely outside of her body for it, she just doesn't remember. So, right. you know, in a way, I hope that it's effective because it represents the way that people like Lenny actually show up in the lives of people who know them, right? Is that mm-hmm. she was there and then she disappeared. And then mm-hmm. there are these little glimpses, right, of knowing that she's still alive and that she's still going through. And then she comes back a survivor. But, you know, that's the reality of it. And that was really hard for me to accept. And she and I, you know, we did a lot of interviewing, a lot of talking. And I, you know, really tried my best to get memories out of her. And then ultimately, mm-hmm. you know, there were interviews that I did with people, you know, in her life that I thought could maybe fill in some of those holes. But then mm-hmm. I realized, no. You know, that like, I think it actually is significant for the reader to like miss her yeah. during those chapters.
I mean, I definitely had that experience. I was like, where did she go? Where yeah. is she? Like, why are we not hearing from her? And it wasn't until she came back that I was like, oh, I think it's because she wasn't able to fully share that part of her life because she doesn't remember it, or the memories are unclear, or it all is jumbled together because of the drug use.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a very rudimentary question, but you do such a good job of explaining this in the book. What is crack?
Yeah. Okay. So I will give you like the big grand metaphysical answer that,
yes.
you know, crack is a substance that came into American life in the early 1980s that completely upended urban communities, and it became the reason for a intensified war on drugs that we're still recovering from. And it launched a lot of myths and really a culture war against Black and Latino Americans in this country. Crack is also the same exact substance chemically as powder cocaine. It has, its original name was freebase, and that's a chemical term for taking a compound like powder cocaine and freeing its base from the other elements, which makes it smokable. So it's the same substance as powder cocaine. It has the same high as powder cocaine, which is euphoria and stimulation, except like anything you smoke, it goes to the brain directly. So it's a very quick high, it's very intense, and it's short-lived. And because of that, you saw a different pattern of use for crack users, which means that you are binging crack as opposed to, you know, what other folks do with powder cocaine, which is, you know, have some and then you're just high for a while and you have a little bit more later. I would liken it for anybody that might be not like clear enough for to like an edible. Right. Like a sort of weed brownie, for example, versus mm-hmm. smoking a joint. A person okay. that, you know, consumes a weed brownie might think, I'm not high. No, that weed brownie had no effect on me. And then maybe 30 minutes, an hour later, you're high for 3 hours. Whereas, okay. you know, somebody that's maybe smoking a joint, you're going to get immediately high and you're going to have to keep smoking a joint to stay high.
Interesting.
You know, that like, that's just the way that like, you know, chemicals work in our bodies. So.
Got it.
Yeah.
But so freebase and crack are the same thing.
Freebase and crack are the exact same thing in terms of the substance that's produced, that there was a different process for making it. Freebase was made with more volatile chemicals, things like ether, and that made it really difficult to make. So, mm-hmm. you know, the stories of people in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, blowing themselves up, trying to freebase, that's because they were using volatile chemicals.
I see.
A little story that I'll share, though, is that in my research, I was told by several different sources that they learned how to make freebase from a handful of Bay Area college students, white students at Berkeley who were cocaine enthusiasts that were experimenting with it, you know, in the way people experiment with drugs, and that they, you know, took powder cocaine under this chemical process and they created freebase. And it became so popular in the Bay that, you know, I was able to track down a book published in the late 70s called The Pleasures of Cocaine that was sold in independent bookstores and what they call head shops. So any place that you could buy like a bong, basically. And that was one of the ways that it became really popular and spread throughout the Bay. And then to LA, right, that the knowledge follows the typical routes, right, of like relationship and connection. So from the Bay to LA, to Seattle, to Portland, from LA to New York, right? And then from New York, you know, up and down the East Coast, and then ultimately then into Middle America. But that's sort of like one of the interesting stories about the origins of crack is that it, you know, it seems as though it was Bay Area hippies that that created it.
Well, as a Bay Area native, I am so proud of our legacy. I guess I knew that crack and cocaine were the same substance, right? Like, I feel like if you read The New Jim Crow, that's really hammered home in the like difference in sentencing. But one of the things that comes up towards the end of the book is about Obama's fair sentencing, like where he reduces, it used to be 101 disparity of crack to cocaine, opposite of cocaine to crack, where you would get, no, I'm sorry, the first time, crack to cocaine, you get 100 years for something that someone who did cocaine would get one or whatever.
Right.
But in Obama's fair sentencing, it's still an 18-1 disparity. So is that fair? Is there a reason why it's 18-1? Like, is there anything about crack that is inherently more dangerous or more anything? Like, because wouldn't fair sentencing be 1-1?
Yeah, you would think, right? That there's nothing.
I thought I was missing something.
You're like, is there? Well, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that just that law that came about in, I believe it was 88, that it was a reaction to the death of Lynn Bias. Lynn Bias was a first round NBA draft pick out of the University of Maryland that got drafted to the Celtics. And the night of the draft, he overdosed on cocaine, not on crack. It turned out, right, that he was not smoking crack, that he had consumed large amounts of cocaine and he died. And politicians in D.C. seized on it to create these laws that, you know, ultimately criminalized cocaine possession more than it did any other drug. And yes, you're right. It was a 100-1 sentencing disparity. So you got, you know, 100 times the amount of time that you would get for powder cocaine for crack. That was just arbitrary, right? That they one-upped each other to that. They were, you know, it should be 10-1. It should be 20-1. And they settled on 100-1. under,
as you do.
You know, it's like, you know, why not just, you know, kind of spitball it? And then, you know, during the Obama administration, all of his sort of criminal justice reform efforts, they knew that they wanted to do something around crack. This was Obama's DOJ under Eric Holder. But it goes to show, you know, despite the fact that we've come so far in some regards in our attitudes about the criminal justice system, that we haven't come far enough, right, that we can accept that they are the same drug and that we that they should get the same amount of time for possession. And it's something that I would like to see out of, you know, me publishing this book. Hopefully we can start a conversation about eliminating that disparity entirely.
Right. And like, you know, decriminalizing drugs or whatever, the Kurt Schmoke line.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like the real goal, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, addiction is a public health issue. That drug epidemics are public health issues, that they, you know, are happening to groups of people at a time. because of factors that have to do with more than just a person's willpower. And, right. You know, the criminal legal stuff is expensive and it's just never worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk more about this. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back on the same topic. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're back. Back to talking about criminalizing and drugs and everything. I feel like with Kurt Schmoke, who is the mayor of Baltimore, black mayor, first elected black mayor, young guy at the time, like sort of, you know, the way that you set it up in the book, and my understanding is that he's sort of like this great black hope for this black city, and that he comes in, I mean, honestly, at the worst possible time, knowing what we know now, for any black person to take over a city, knowing that racism exists and the double standards and all of those things. He comes in and he's like, I'm going to fix education. And then it's like, hey guys, surprise, here's Coke. Good luck. And he pretty much right away is like, we should decriminalize this. And everyone is like, this nigga is tripping. Like, this is what's wrong with black people.
Right.
We just told you there's a drug epidemic and you said, let them eat cake. And they rip him to shreds. They basically are just, they call him every name under the book. They make him this horrible villain, whatever. his constituents stick with him. He does three terms as the mayor of Baltimore through the crack epidemic. He is there into the beginning stages as the whole thing is ending. Everything is happening. He sticks by his lines. He puts together like commissions to try to figure out things. The needle exchange program that now is like kind of commonplace. He's spearheads that. And I guess the question is, I guess more of a comment, or I guess a question observation. We often talk about that was just the time. And everybody in 1845 owned slaves, right? Everybody in Germany was a Nazi. Like, they were just following orders. And then we get stories of people like Kurt Schmoke, who at the time, in the face of all of this other shit, was like, no, this is, treatment is great. Decriminalizing would be helpful. Here are some options. And I guess the question in all of that is like, what can we learn from Kurt Schmoke aside from stick to your guns? Like, what is the lesson in him and his service? And because it got bad in Baltimore.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. You know, Kurt, I really just love as a character, because he reminds me of like so many of the really nerdy guys that I went to Morehouse with. And I should say that he was so much more than a nerd, right? Like, Kurt Schmoke integrates or helps integrate Baltimore City College, which is a high school in Baltimore. He was captain of the football team his junior and senior year, took them to and won state championships both of those years. He was senior class president. He, you know, then gets recruited to play football for Yale. He stops a riot at Yale. And
right. That's my favorite story. That's yeah. great. That's great. And then Gotta get the book for that one, people.
Right. You know, and like, and then the faculty is so pleased with him that they, you know, unanimously nominate him for a Rhodes Scholarship. He, you know, then goes to Oxford and to Harvard. And he wants nothing more than to go back to Baltimore and become mayor. Given all of that, right? So this is like right. super admirable guy. And, you know, he reminds me of myself in that he thought that, you know, a good idea was a good idea. And right. that, you know, and that after having thought about it and done the research, and his, you know, wife was a physician, that he thought that Baltimore, given all of its health resources and its public health resources, could be a model city for decriminalization. And especially with Baltimore, you know, which was, you know, experiencing a crack epidemic, but it's always had a huge problem with heroin and opioids, which people then, you know, skyrocketing rates of HIV, AIDS infection because of the intravenous drug use. He thought, we can't afford to criminalize this. We have to have a public health response that, you know, gives out needles and, you know, helps people. And like you said, he was called every name, you know, in the book, including by people like Marion Barry, who right. said, like you said, this nigga tripping. Why would yeah. he, you know, think that the thing to do would be to like decriminalize drugs? And
Marion Barry was the black mayor of Washington, D.C., who was also using crack.
Yes. He ultimately, you know, was put in prison for cocaine possession. Caught in, you know, on tape in a sting, smoking crack. And, you know, the lesson for me from Kurt Schmoke is that sometimes a good idea isn't enough. Sometimes it isn't enough to be smart and to make sense, that like a part of the work of creating good policy is like building consensus and getting people knowledgeable and informed, right, about the things that you're discussing, because fear is powerful and shame is powerful. And, you know, people ultimately chose their fear over a good idea.
Right. Okay, let's work our way up the political ladder. We go from city mayor to president of the United States. We've got Nixon and we've got Reagan. We know from history, from, I can't remember the guy's name, but one of Nixon's, or a few of Nixon's people, they knew what the fuck they were doing. They're, you know, we know that they're on tape talking about, we can't say this, we have to say this. Like, we can't say nigger anymore. We have to say, you know, states' rights. And we know that they knew what they were doing in criminalizing marijuana and cocaine because, or I think it was marijuana and heroin at the time, because of counterculture hippies and because of urban centers. Like, they were purposefully attacking people who were anti-war and then Black people with this war on drugs. My question is about Ronald Reagan. How much do we feel like Ronald Reagan knew that playbook versus he was given that playbook?
Yeah. I think that Ronald Reagan, my like personal kind of assessment is that Ronald
Reagan. Yeah, that's what I'm asking. I know that you don't know. It's just like something like, because I feel like we put it on Nixon really hard. And then I know that Reagan did fucked up shit, but how much of this was just like, here you go, kid.
Yeah, yeah. That playbook, you know, as you point out, goes back to Nixon at least. You know, right. Nixon's law and order, war on drugs playbook, you know, he only got to kind of taste a little bit of it because he ultimately got, you know, impeached and then resigned from office. But, you know, it was completely picked up by Reagan and his administration because it was starting to become so effective under Nixon. And Reagan, as, you know, the great communicator, was able to take it to lengths and, you know, that I don't think Nixon could have even imagined. One, on like the policy level, right? Like the sort of laws that came out under Reagan. But Reagan's real contribution to the war on drugs is this messaging that completely vilified and demonized anybody involved in drugs. And, you know, one of the things that I love to point out from my research that I found to be really interesting is that, you know, the Reagans used their Hollywood connections, the fact that they have been in Hollywood, that they knew lots of people in media and advertising, to completely infiltrate television during the 80s and 90s with anti-drug messaging. So, you know, you get the very special episode of your favorite sitcom. Right.
Saved by the Bell, baby. Not Jesse popping pills.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I'm so scared.
I'm so scared. Right.
So, you know, or like, you know, Nancy Reagan is on Different Strokes. Or, you know, there's even an episode of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air where Carlton, I think, is on some type of like speed at like a high school dance. That all of that messaging comes out of the Reagan White House. And they also set aside a tremendous amount of funding for PSAs, an agency, I'm kind of blanking on it right now, the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Oh, so, yes, of course.
So, you know, this is your brain on drugs. And, you know,
those
all
commercials
of that stuff,
with the egg.
With the egg, right?
Oh, my God.
And, you know, some people would credit that for anti-drug attitudes that sort of came later, but there was so much misinformation in those ads, and there was so much harm created through the misinformation and through the ways that drug addicts were presented, that, you know, that like they were doing all of this additional harm, you know, because it was politically valuable.
Right. Okay, we'll stay on the media, though I do have another Reagan question maybe later. I do want to say we're the same age. I'm 86, you're 87. And when I think back on my childhood and I think about those campaigns and also the way that AIDS was portrayed in the media, I can't blame anybody for my brain, but I do feel that a lot of my anxiety has come from the way that I was so scared to be in the world. Like that by touching anyone or anything or speaking to anyone or like ever looking at a drug or anything, that I would become, you know, a quote unquote crackhead, or that like there's something about the way that those media campaigns that I've just started to think about more recently is just like, I was so scared of sex. I was so scared of drugs. I was so scared of alcohol, that in a way that like feels maybe too far.
Unhealthy. Right.
Yeah. Like that, a neuroses almost.
Absolutely. That like we, you know, HIV, AIDS, crack predate us. Right. That we never got to live in a world where those things didn't exist. which is a part of why I wanted to write the book and why the book starts, you know, in the 1960s, because I really wanted to know what our world was like before in order to just ground, you know, my like sense of things, but also to understand just how much was lost in terms of our ability to connect to each other. And I think that, you know, like you, I was afraid of sex. I was afraid of drugs, but also I was afraid of other people.
Other people. Totally. Totally.
You know, and sadly, you know, as like a Black person that grew up in a Black neighborhood, I was afraid of other Black people in some ways. Right. Yeah. And I was afraid of this idea that I would be confused as a crack baby, or that people would take me for a super predator. And it was this, you know, it was like, you know, it didn't just keep me away from drugs. It also poisoned my imagination about myself and about my neighbors. And, you know, all of that is still being undone and unlearned. And, you know, and researching this book and ultimately writing it, you know, helped me kind of unpack some of that, you know, internalized bias that I had against my own community.
And yeah, and I think it does sort of like, it definitely has stuck with me. Like there are times where like I will catch myself feeling a way that I'm like, that is like the weirdest thought to pop into your head about, you know, like it's just, it was so formative for us. And like by the time we have probably memories about that stuff, it was like such a well-oiled machine, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, cause like in the beginning there was, especially, I mean, around AIDS, there was like confusion and there was not like, but by the time we're coming up in like not the 90s, it's like, oh, this is what AIDS is. And this is, and like, be scared. And then I guess, you know, back to the book, the media and crack had a very intimate and abusive relationship. The media was horrible. Can you just tell people about Jimmy's World? Because I did not know about Jimmy's World. And that made my stomach hurt. Right. So will you just fill people in about, I think that's like also like quintessential crack and the media story, like to kind of illustrate this abusive relationship.
So, you know, Jimmy's World, you know, I think of as kind of like this prototypical, you know, urban America drug story. And it was written by a woman named Janet Cook, who was a Metro reporter for The Washington Post. And it was about a 9-year-old, actually heroin addict named Jimmy in Washington, D.C. And the story was that Jimmy was, he grew up basically in a heroin shooting gallery that his mom operated, that they gave him heroin to like calm down throughout the day, that he was the product of incest, a relationship between his grandfather and his mother, that, you know, really everything terrible.
That his stepfather would shoot him up with drugs.
Right, right, exactly. Right. And that
Really stuck with me. Can you tell?
I mean, because it's just wild, right? And like the Washington Post ran this on the front page of the paper in the 1980s. And it was a huge story, right, that caused like a big national stir. And it turned out that the entire thing was fabricated.
It won the Pulitzer.
Oh, yes. Right. So
she won the Pulitzer Prize.
That's a very important point to make, that Janet Cook won the Pulitzer Prize.
And she's a Black woman.
A Black woman from Toledo, Ohio. You know, I'm also from Ohio. You know, she was a young reporter that she won the Pulitzer for. So a few things. One, it appeared on the cover of the paper without any images, completely with illustrations, supposedly because, you know, she was protecting her source. That her editor never really fully investigated, right? Like, you know, as a journalist, at least your editor should know who an anonymous source is. Her editor had never met Jimmy, had never verified Jimmy's existence, that the paper at the time was being edited by Bob Woodward, of, you know, the Watergate scandal fame, somebody that knows anonymous sourcing better than anybody. All of these people were so eager to tell this story that they put aside all of their journalistic values and integrity, ran it on the front page of the paper, despite the objection of other Black reporters at the paper who said, there's right. no way this is real, that it doesn't sound real. It doesn't sound like our community. We don't think Janet even has the balls to go into that neighborhood and actually find a Jimmy. And they said, and they chalked it up to professional jealousy. And then they nominated it for a Pulitzer Prize. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and then everything came tumbling down. All because of another lie, which was that Janet had lied about being a graduate of Vassar. And they could not confirm that. So then they looked into the Jimmy story, and, you know, the truth came out. And it is still today the only Pulitzer Prize to ever be given back was this Pulitzer by this Black woman who really wanted to make a big splash. And she knew better than anybody that the way to do that was with this completely anti-Black, pathological story about a 9-year-old drug addict in DC. And it is still today, I think, one of the most fascinating scam stories.
It's I would read an entire book on it.
You know? And, right? You know, I am working on something.
Oh, yes! You heard it here first, people. Yeah.
You know, but it is a really fascinating story. You know, and like to your earlier point, then, that even though this huge thing happens with Jimmy's World that should have really shook up the entire journalism industry, that the industry still went on to perpetuate lots of myths and lies about right. Black people and drugs, including the crack baby myth, right. which, you know, was this idea that cocaine exposure in utero would have these irreversible damaging effects on the development of children. And that's how you got the crack baby idea. Now, I should note, right, that it's important to say substance abuse or use while pregnant is bad, right? Right. That it can do things like separate your uterus from the uterine wall. And then ultimately, a lot of women gave birth to premature babies that had tons right. of issues. But what the scientists were finding when they were looking at these so-called crack babies were things actually associated with premature birth.
Right. And it was like there's no difference between a preemie and a baby who is exposed to crack who was also a preemie.
Right. And that this entire kind of generation of young people went on to actually be healthy in most cases, but they lived under this cloud of you will always be irredeemably broken. Mm-hmm. That was the belief that a Washington Post columnist wrote that death would have been better for these children mm-hmm. than to have been born exposed to cocaine. And that's a wild thing to say. And it was commonplace.
Right.
To say
I think what's interesting about the Jimmy's World story is like you're getting at, it's like you would think a story like that would stop a lot of this in its tracks. But then, of course, there's capitalism and there's these newspapers that want to sell copies. And so then it's like, okay, this one was a lie, but let's go out and find a real Jimmy. Let's go out and find another salacious story. I mean, I didn't know this, but you say in the book that the television show 48 Hours is a spinoff of crack reporting, where it's like they were doing like 48 hours in like a crack den, and then it just became the show 48 hours. Like that's a crazy origin story for a show that's like so ubiquitous in American culture. It was just like, let's fucking find people and hang out with them for 48 hours and watch them do drugs and just fucking film it and just jack off to it because we're so happy to see people dying.
That is exactly it. That we were caught, that like the nation was caught in this moral panic where, you know, this was entertainment and people were, you know, kind of getting their fix of, you know, true crime from what was happening in urban America. And yeah, the show was originally called 48 Hours on Crack Street. And they just went around to watch people do drugs and talk to them about drug use. And then they did, it was such a big hit that a year later they did Return to Crack Street.
Of course. Gotta go back.
You know, and then that launched, you know, a show now, which is like one of like the longest running news magazine programs, 48 Hours. You know, a ton of movies. There was a movie called Crack House that was, you know, put in theaters in the 1980s, starring the football player Jim Brown, about a drug dealer and pimp that, you know, operates a crack house. And it was a form of entertainment, actually. Right. And I still think that, you know, in like the sort of American imagination, that these stories about crack and crack use are a form of entertainment, that, you know,
I think so too.
People laugh at at the crackhead character or figure. Mm-hmm. People are excited and, you know, energized by the idea of drug kingpins. And mm-hmm. that, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote this book is because I think that there's so much context and meaning from the real stories that if people knew them, that they wouldn't, that the fake stories wouldn't have so much entertainment value.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. And I, in the book, you know, so the book starts at the beginning, it kind of goes through chronologically, and we kind of get to the end of the crack epidemic, right? And like, there are still people who do crack. There are still people, you know, like that is not, it's not over. The effects are still being felt, but you kind of point out that mostly the people who are still doing crack are people who were doing crack back then. There's not a lot of like new crack users. But a lot of the media we were just talking about is white media, mainstream media, and some of the stuff that helped bring down crack or like end crack was community organizing, civic organizations, but also hip hop music. And I think that's really interesting because hip hop music, of course, gets this rap and like hip hop artists, like you're glorifying drug use and, you know, Jay-Z sold drugs and he's trying to make it sexy and like all this stuff. But you give so many examples about how hip hop artists, rap artists were actually like really pivotal in doing that. And I'm wondering like, is that also true of other like black media at the time? Was black media getting it right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I got a new respect for hip hop and black media from reporting this book because, you know, I had grown up kind of hearing the refrain that hip hop was just, you know, kind of a mirror to like, you know, what's happening in the streets, and I always thought, maybe that's a bit of a cop out because, you know, any music, like any musical form can be like a mixed bag. But then when I actually looked at the record, what I saw was that there were hip hop artists that were rapping about the dangers of crack and drug use and drug dealing as early as 1982. And mainstream media didn't start focusing on crack until about 1987. So if you were a young kid growing up in the 80s, you were getting anti-crack messaging first from hip hop. Before you were ever getting it from Nancy Reagan or anybody else. And then, you know, and this isn't just marginal, right? Like conscious rappers, you're talking about NWA with songs like Dope Man, MC Shan with Jane, Stop This Crazy Thing, Public Enemy, Night of the Living Bassheads, you know, comparing crack users to zombies, which is extreme, right? But it's still anti-crack messaging. And then you also see it in like the filmmaking, which I would sort of call hip hop filmmaking at the time. You have Spike Lee with movies like Jungle Fever, right? You have crack addict characters in movies like Menace to Society. I mean, like the list goes on and on and on of anti-crack messaging that was coming from black artists. A really interesting thing that I like to point out is that you have, according to research done by the Department of Justice, that the crack epidemic really peaks around 1990. It plateaus for a while and then completely takes a nosedive around 1992. And it hasn't, you know, recovered. Rates of hard drug use among Black and Latinos hasn't, you know, haven't recovered since then. 1992, right, the year that it completely plummets, happens to be the year that Dr. Dre dropped The Chronic. And what you see, too, is that that same year, marijuana use among young people skyrockets. So, you know, my theory is that when it came time to experiment with drugs, that a new cohort of young people decided, I don't want to touch this stuff that has been so devastating in my community.
Right.
But my favorite rapper on this really one of the greatest albums of all time is sort of extolling the wonders, right, of marijuana. And you see marijuana use take off. That to me is fascinating, right? How like that kind of like intervention, so to speak, right, can like completely change the sort of direction of a community. And it is important to point out that communities of color did not get any help for the crack epidemic besides criminalization. So when it came to actually ending the cycle of addiction, that part, that was something that we did ourselves by making different choices, by creating programs in our communities to keep people alive and to help people get clean. It was, you know, grandmothers taking in grandchildren while mm-hmm. their kids were out in the streets. It was churches doing, you know, gun buybacks. It was young people saying, I'm actually good on that. I want to do something else. And, you know, no, we didn't have, you know, huge programs that completely changed things overnight, but we kept each other alive. And that for me is like, that's what community is. Community is not, you know, big programs. Community is how we keep each other alive. And and that is like the ultimate message of the book, is that the kinds of investments that we made are into each other should have been and should be bolstered by greater society, by the government. Mm-hmm. That when we look at something like the ongoing opioid epidemic, we shouldn't be trying to recreate the wheel. We should look at who's doing the work in communities right now and how can we support them. If it's grandparents taking in grandchildren, how can we, you know, give them some assistance to make that easier instead of breaking up families? You know, if it's community organizations that are, you know, busting up, you know, places where folks are doing drugs, how do we support and protect them in doing that work instead of just saying, let's send in the police and lock everybody up? Because that doesn't fix it. All that doesn't does is create room and then new dealers and new users move in.
Right. This is like such a hard shift, but I have to ask you this. I ask everybody, what's a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Restaurant.
Oh, you're in the restaurant club. So the restaurant club is a very famous, well-known club here in the Stacks. It includes people like Angelina Jolie, Quentin Tarantino, Jason Reynolds, and now you. So the restaurant club, there's other people in it. I can never remember, but those are the big three. But welcome to the restaurant club.
Oh my God, Tracy. You know what it is? I struggle so bad with like the French language. I mean, like I can't pronounce anything French barely, and I can't spell anything with French origin. So I'm actually surprised about Angelina Jolie. See, she has to dig back into her roots and see if she can bring some of that French back. But
Okay. And how do you like to write? How many hours a day? How often? Music or no? At the house, out of the house, snacks, beverages, rituals. Talk about it.
I like to write, in the middle of the day with complete silence for really no more than 3 hours. Okay. And I write best if I write on a blank page. So when I was writing...
No lines.
Well, no. I mean, when I was writing When Crack Was King, I could not open up the Word document and then continue where I left off.
I see.
Because my inclination is to read at least like the last three pages. And then I end up just editing. I had to open up new Word documents in order to get it done. Or I had to open up an email and send it to myself as a way of generating that urgency.
Huh. I love that. Snacks or beverages?
Oh, every beverage under the sun. I mean, give me five beverages at a time. Give me a coffee. Give me a seltzer. Give me just like a still water. Give me a soda. I need to be able...
What kind of soda?
I'm a Diet Coke person.
Me too. Also a famous club, includes myself and Samantha Irby, famously.
You know what? So like, this is like the dream lunch, right? Chicken Caesar salad, or maybe a shrimp Caesar salad.
Okay. Okay. Love a Caesar.
Very hot French fries. Thin French fries.
Okay. When are we going out to lunch? This is like totally my vibe. Okay.
And then a Diet Coke with a lot of ice.
Okay. Fountain Diet Coke is my personal favorite.
Okay.
Like going to 7-Eleven and getting a fountain Diet Coke with the like straw.
Yeah.
The best. Yeah. I love this. I love this. Okay. We're like so out of time, but I have a few more questions I have to ask you. One is, what is not in the book that you wish could have been?
What's not in the book? I mean, it's a big book. Let me say like there's a lot of stuff in the book.
You can say nothing also. Do you feel like everything that you wanted to be in the book made it into the book?
Well, you know what? And I'm not just saying this to like to pander. I wish that I could have included more women in the book. Mm-hmm. Namely, there are some very interesting stories of women dealers. There's a woman named Thelma out of Philly who was an actual queen pin. And I think that, you know, that there were women dealers, that women, you know, weren't just the addicts, that there were women leaders and like community folks that had incredible interventions. It's just that, you know, a lot of those women were just reluctant to talk to me because mm-hmm. those periods of time were so scary in many ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I really lucked out that I was able to connect with Lenny, who, you know, not only was so open, but who trusted me to handle her story with like a level of sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For people who love this book, what else would you recommend to them that's in conversation with what you've created?
Ooh, I think people should read The Warmth of Other Suns.
Yeah.
Because I sort of see, at least I hope that when Crack Was King picks up where The Warmth of Other Suns kind of leaves off. I think people should read The Condemnation of Blackness by Khalil Gibran Muhammad, which is really sort of an academic book about the ways that Black identity became associated with like a criminal identity. Mm-hmm. I think that people should read The New Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Because Michelle Alexander kind of really gets into like the policy kind of implications of the crack epidemic. And then finally, I want to say that people should read a book called S Street Rising, which is by a former Washington Post journalist named Ruben Castaneda, who covered crime in D.C. during the 80s and also during that period became addicted to crack.
Mm. I'm going to throw in a book because I accidentally read your book back to back with this book, not knowing that they were connected. But you know Alta Adams, the restaurant?
Yes, absolutely.
And you know Keith Corbin, one of the owners. He's the Black guy who owns the restaurant.
Okay.
He was a Grape Street Crip. He was cooking crack for years. He's our age as well. He eventually goes to prison for like an armed robbery or something. Obviously, his story has a happy ending because he's now the owner of Alta Adams.
Yeah.
But as I literally finished your book and started his book right after, and it was wild because he was talking about the same shit and he's like explaining how he was cooking the drugs and like how much baking soda and how he used water because it made it heavier and like all of this shit. And also talking about being a young person and like going to these old heads, like because he's, you know, it's like such a perfect fit for what you did, like a really personal experience. And I was like, kept turning to my husband and being like, this is so fucking weird because these books are like book siblings. I want to ask you, this is not a question that I normally ask people, but I know this about you because you've posted it on social media and it's also in the afterword of your book. This book took a huge toll on you physically, mentally, like your health. You had to like, you know, you had to have health things which you can share or not. So given all of that going in, so we're talking a few days before your book comes out. What is it feeling like for you now knowing this book is going into the world? Like, is it exciting? Are you nervous? Does it feel like, I don't know, just what is that like for you?
This book has taught me so much. You know, as you said, it took a lot from me for a period. I started the book in about 2018 and I spent years with this subject matter, which can be really, really heavy. And, you know, kind of just like absorbing these stories, it raised my anxiety through the roof. And I've, you know, always been an anxious person and my work has always been a source of anxiety, but it was both the work and the stories. And, you know, it got to be 2020 and I was still working on the book and the world was falling apart and I would sit down to write and I would break out in hives from head to toe. Mm. And then I started losing weight. I could barely eat and I lost about 40 pounds. And then I got heart palpitations and had to wear a heart monitor. And what I realized is that as I was trying to make sense of everything that I was learning, my body was like metabolizing the trauma. And something that I had to do was I had to take breaks. I had to care for myself. I had to create practices that were restorative and healing. And, you know, as like hard and scary as that period was, I realized that this is actually a part of the work that anybody that survived this era should have access to, right? Mm. That people need to heal in ways that we don't even know, that people are carrying it around. And for me, it was just kind of squashed together in like a really short period of time. It was like condensed. Right. But other folks are walking around with this tiredness, with this weariness, with this anxiousness. So, you know, I decided to write about it. One, for anybody that's going to write a book, to know that like it is hard, it is taxing. And then also for people who might connect to the story to say, hey, you're probably carrying around some of this too. And you should check that out before it takes a toll on you. And, you know, I'm out on it, you know, on the other side, wishing that I hadn't gained some of the weight back, you know, but also like, you know, that being a symbol of the extent to which like I'm getting well and I feel really good. And I'm like excited for people to read it and to have conversations about it. And it feels like a relief.
I'm so glad. Okay. Last question. If you could have one person dead or alive read When Crack Was King, who would you want it to be?
I would want my Uncle Walter to read When Crack Was King. My Uncle Walter was somebody that dealt with addiction for most of his life. And, you know, he died way too early, I think, because of the impact that addiction just had on his body. And I don't know if he ever felt seen and understood, or even if he understood why those things were happening to him. And I would love for him to read the book and then for us to talk about it.
All right, everybody. You can get When Crack Was King, A People's History of a Misunderstood Era by Donovan X. Ramsey. It is out in the world now as you are listening to it. It has my huge stamp of approval. I loved the book. Donovan, this was such a great conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tracy. And I can't wait for us to get that launch.
Oh my God, I can't wait. We'll set that up immediately. And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Donovan X. Ramsey for joining the show. I'd also like to thank Andrea Pura for helping to make this conversation possible. Don't forget, the Stacks Book Club pick for July is Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. And we will be discussing that book on July 26th with Joel Christian Gill. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to leave us a rating or a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and TikTok and now Threads, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.